When you're asked to vote for someone, it is a very important thing and decision that you will make. You can decide not to vote at all, or you can decide to vote without thinking about it. You might decide in Northern Ireland to vote orange or green. That's your prerogative. You might also decide to have a look at the party's manifesto and look through what they're promising you and decide whether it's actually going to affect your life or not. And that's why I'm deeply grateful for the politicians who have come in to the Nolan studio so that we have the time and space this morning to go through the promises that they are making to you ahead of the vote. Conor Murphy is sitting with me today. How are you, Conor?
I'm good, Stephen.
Good morning.
Imagine why.
Are you excited about this election?
Well, it's a challenge, as all elections are. It's a challenging time of the year. Outside this morning is a pretty gruesome day, and Thursday seems to be predicted to be something similar. But nonetheless, elections are called, and we try and rise to the occasion and fight them, put out our message, activate our teams, select our candidates, and try and achieve the biggest possible vote for our candidates.
I set up before any of these interviews all day and all night, haven't had much sleep, reading through the manifesto. I didn't really need to sit up too long through yours. It's relatively short compared to other political parties. And one of the biggest issues facing us in this country is the health service. And some of your voters and others sitting on waiting lists. It's hardly mentioned.
Well, this is the third manifesto we've published this year. We did one for local government elections, one for European elections, and now this. This is a Brexit election. This isn't a normal election. It wasn't called in the normal cycle of governments coming and going. It was called specifically on the Brexit issue, and that is the biggest threat and difficulty that we face. A lot of other issues flow from that, such as funding for public services and implications for public services as a consequence of Brexit, implications for the economy, implications for agriculture. And so the focus clearly is on Brexit because, in effect, given the manner in which the British Prime Minister called this election, people are being asked to give their verdict in relation to leave or remain. And that has been the key debate among society over the last while. Of course, health
you
is a huge issue.
You want this to be a Brexit election. That's what you want it to be. I would put it to you that when you're rapping doors, when the people are listening to this programme, particularly the type of people who Sinn Féin need to reach out to, working class people that don't have many thousands of pounds for free healthcare, for private healthcare, and you're seriously telling them this morning this election is just about Brexit? It's not about whether they can trust you to take them off a waiting list if their kid might have a cancer growing inside them, or if their child is lying on a waiting list, or their granny is lying on a waiting list? You're distancing yourselves from that, are you?
Not at all. And we've talked over the last week or two almost on a daily basis about the challenges facing the health service.
And your manifesto you haven't.
Because the manifesto was published for this election, and this election was called in and around the Brexit issue. And this, I've been out on the doors, Stephen, talking to people who support us, people who don't support us. And the primary issue for people is around the politics, is around the uncertainty around Brexit.
Ahead of them dying? Sitting on a waiting list in Northern Ireland where there are over 300,000 people. Here's a statistic for you. Over 300,000 people in this country, here in Northern Ireland, sitting on a waiting list. Know what the comparable figure is for England and Wales put together? 6,000. Is it not deeply offensive that given how grotesquely out of step Northern Ireland is on waiting lists, that you sit here this morning and say it's nothing to do with this election? Maybe it should be so far up there that there's nothing else in your mind than the health service.
Well, firstly, I haven't said it's nothing to do with this election. What I said is this election was caused primarily around the Brexit issue. It is an opportunity for people to give their verdict on the approach to Brexit over the last number of years by the British government, supported by the DUP, and to once again reaffirm the commitment of the people here right across the political spectrum to remain within the European Union. The issues of health, people are capable of joining the dots, Stephen. They know that the 9 years of austerity policies has a huge damage on our public health services and our public services generally. They see the images yesterday from England of a child sleeping on the floor of a hospital suffering from pneumonia. They know that the health service is in difficulty right across England and Scotland and Wales, as well as here. And it's as a consequence of cuts to public services, cuts to finance, austerity policies, which have been brought in by a Tory government supported by the DUP.
But Conor, that's my point. My point is, there is a photograph of a child across the water that was found in a hospital lying on the floor, and it became national news everywhere. We have grotesque waiting figures, with citizens in Northern Ireland dying on waiting lists, and we have you and your leader, Michelle O'Neill, telling us this election is nothing to do with anything but Brexit. So it happens across the water, one child, and it's national news, and here you tell us nothing to do with this election. The Health Service.
No, we haven't said that at all.
Well, let me let you hear your leader, Michelle O'Neill, what she told Talkback when she was asked, why is health only mentioned once in your manifesto? Listen to how Michelle answered this.
What it tells us is that this election is about Brexit, and we've very much focused in our manifesto around the challenges of Brexit, the negative implications of Brexit, what we have done in terms of Brexit, and actually what we intend to do in terms of making politics work. So whilst I know that many other political parties would like to talk about many other given topic, and obviously health is a huge topic and I'm happy to talk about it, but this election is fundamentally about Brexit. It's about the rejection of Brexit. It's about the rejection of the DUP and the chaos at Westminster.
Yes, that's what it is fundamentally about. That doesn't mean that it's exclusively about that, but that is why this election was called. It was called as a consequence of the Brexit debate in Britain. It was called in order to try and secure the Tories a majority. Public services, most importantly including health, are suffering as a consequence of the continued position of a Tory government, their austerity policies. Those have been supported by the DUP, and that's what we have said clearly. This election is about a verdict on Brexit. It is a verdict on this government and on the DUP who have kept them in power for the last three years while they continue to impose strident cuts in relation to our public services, which have a very detrimental impact, and particularly on health and on education.
But if that was true, and by the way, the figure I said earlier, I'm getting mixed up in the figures, 133,000 patients are waiting more than a year for hospital treatment here. 133,000 patients. And in England and Wales, with a population more than 30 times larger than us here in Northern Ireland, the figure is less than 6,000. Now, if it is true what you're saying, that it is the DUP's fault, or it's anybody's fault but yours, and we'll come on to that, then surely this election is an opportunity for you to set out to the country how you're going to fix it.
Well,
and there are about seven words in your whole manifesto about a crisis here.
I mean, health has been in crisis for a number of years now. This election, as I say, has been called in relation to the Brexit issue, and that's the primary focus of it. That doesn't mean it's
your
exclusive
focus. That doesn't make it right.
No, that has been the primary focus in Britain in relation to the election as well. It is about the Brexit outcome that the various British political parties desire. Now, what we have said clearly
is... tell me that kid in the front page of the Daily Mirror isn't an election issue?
Of course it's an election issue.
What about the 133,000 people here?
Yeah.
Why is it not an election issue for you?
It is an election issue for us.
It's not in your manifesto. And your leader are telling us this election is primarily about Brexit.
The manifesto goes through the issues in relation to the impact of austerity policies and the detrimental impact they've had on our public service. And what we've said is it's clearly an opportunity for people to reject the policies of the British government, supported by the DUP, to reject Brexit and to reaffirm our commitment to remain in the European Union. And clearly the issues...
None of that gets anybody off a waiting list in Northern Ireland, does it?
No, but the rejection of Tory austerity policies will have an impact on that. The DUP had an opportunity 3 years ago to support a Labour government coming in who promised to restore public spending, but they chose instead to support a Tory government who continued to impose very severe cuts on already suffering public services. And quite clearly the argument we've made over many years is that public services here are at such a difficulty they suffer more than public services may suffer in Britain. And that's clearly borne out in relation to the waiting list figure.
For those people contemplating voting for Sinn Féin who disagree with you, who are deeply frustrated that there's not more from all of you in Sinn Féin about the health service, and they don't have a lot of money, they can't buy private health care, like for example I can, and they can't, and they're just as good a citizen as I am or anybody else is, how do you reach out to them this morning to reassure them that you will help get them off that waiting list? And the amount of cancer patients in this country that aren't even getting seen to be told they've got cancer and therefore they've a chance of survival.
Yeah.
What do you say to them?
Yeah, but we live in the community and we have people and families and friends that are in the same position as the people you outline. And we say there is a possibility of a better future. The way to do that is to end the influence and the policies of this Tory government on us, to stop local parties keeping them in power, to get back an executive up and functioning, and to make the argument and the case for sufficient public funding to support genuine proper services, properly funded services, properly resourced services, and that we can get back to actually taking care of people again.
The nurses are currently involved, and other healthcare workers, Connor, are involved in industrial action. There's a strike scheduled for, it's the 18th of this month. Do you support them?
Yes, I think it's unfortunate and that they find themselves in a position where they have to take action. But I do support their right to take industrial action, as I do with any workers.
Well, supporting their right to take industrial action is different from their current industrial action. Do you support it?
I do support their current industrial action, yes. They have made a case for many years in relation to pay parity, in relation to insufficient staffing, patient safety issues that arise as a consequence of that. And I think they have got to a point where the issues they've been raising over many years have not been properly dealt with, and they felt that they have no option but to take industrial action, and I support their right to do that.
Haven't been dealt, because this is a test of Sinn Féin. You're going to try to push the responsibility onto the DUP. You're no doubt going to tell me that it was Jim Wells who broke parity. That's nurses and doctors and health workers getting the same pay as elsewhere in the UK.
Well, I'm going to tell you that we take responsibility for our decisions, and the DUP should take responsibility for theirs.
Okay. What about your decision when Michelle O'Neill was health minister to not restore parity?
Because there was a 1% pay cap, and she gave an award of 1%, which was in line with the pay cap for public sector
wages.
What
do you mean a pay cap?
There was a pay cap imposed at that stage over a number of years. It's now gone in recent years, but there was a pay cap.
Did she not have the ministerial discretion?
There was a pay cap right across public sector workers of 1%. The problem that
did she have discretion to go above the 1%?
No, that was a pay cap which was imposed across and
imposed
agreed.
By whom?
Imposed from the British government, a pay cap across all public sector
so
employees.
So you followed your masters?
Well, let me say, the reason that Michelle O'Neill was faced with a consequence where more than 1% was required is because two previous DUP health ministers, even with advice from the pay review body to increase payment by 1%, refused to do so. And she ended up then inheriting a two-year situation where the pay hadn't been increased at all. So when she was able to give the 1% increase, which she did, that still left people short. And that's the deficit that has carried through to the present day. And that is largely the cause of the industrial action that we're seeing in relation to the health workers.
I've been looking at this, and because I've been getting bombarded by different press machines about the realities of this. The reality is, when the DUP broke parity, and it was a DUP minister that broke parity, you see, part of the reason, Connor, why some people might vote for Sinn Féin is for you to stand up to the DUP if they are a supporter of Sinn Féin. Mm. Why didn't you stand up to the DUP when Wells broke parity?
Because the DUP minister took the decision within the autonomy of his own department.
You could have challenged that.
There was a budget increase voted at that time for the health service. He took there is ministerial autonomy. That's part of the...
No, you could have challenged it.
That's part of the arrangements. What we did was we secured him additional money for the health service, and he took a decision not to pay the 1%. John O'Dowd, at the same time, paid the 1% for education workers within his department. And then subsequent to that, Simon Hollington followed the same course of action, even though the pay review body recommended that he give a 1% increase. And it is that deficit which is carried now over a number of years, which leaves staff here at a much poorer position than staff in Britain.
And that's what you want us to believe?
That's the truth of the matter.
Well, here's the truth of the matter. Mm. There is legislation that would have allowed you to challenge Jim Wells when he was breaking parity in Northern Ireland, when he was deciding to pay nurses less than those elsewhere in the UK. And Sinn Féin, with all of that influence and the power that you had when you were given a mandate to be in that executive, you did not use it. Why not?
What's the legislation that is
the legislation basically is around any controversial issue in the executive. A cross-cutting measure. The DUP used it twice. For example, the DUP used it in the BMAP plan with Mark Durkin. The DUP used it with Michelle O'Neill around the Common Agricultural Policy. Any matter controversial to the executive, that you could have forced that to come in front of you.
By honesty, one of those occasions the DUP went to court rather than use legislation in relation to steps Michelle O'Neill was taking.
Well, they went to court based on the legislation, and the judge referred to the legislation that was in there.
There is ministerial autonomy within the departments. Jim Wells was given a pay increase by the budgetary increase by the Assembly when they voted additional monies for health, and he decided not to pay that 1%.
Why didn't you challenge it? Why didn't you declare it as a controversial matter and challenge it?
Well, I wasn't in the executive at that time, but I do know that there is, we were asserting the autonomy of ministers at that time within their own departments. And Jim Wales took that decision. Simon Hamilton took a similar decision.
Asserting the autonomy of ministers.
Yeah.
In other words, backing them up.
No, no, no. What the DUP had attempted to do through various devices was to interfere in a range of departments, even when they had no authority to do that. And what we had done, and what the Good Friday Agreement agreed, and the St Andrews Agreement, was that ministers had autonomy within their own departments.
You see, it's a statement of fact. And is it not a shining light of an example of where, again, Sinn Féin could have used the power in front of them, could have declared that a controversial matter. You chose not to. You chose not to stand up to the DUP when you were doing that. And now you're hoping that people either won't know or will forget you had that power when you're standing side by side with the nurses now. They should know you did not fight for them when you could have done.
Well, I point you to the record of Michelle O'Neill when she had the power in the Department of Health, that she gave them a pay rise, that she created additional training places for nurses which had been reduced, that she initiated the reform process within the health department, across the health system. That's our record. She had said when she gave the 1% pay increase that that was the beginning, and she had obviously intended, had the executive survived, to get back to parity over the course of the lifetime of that executive. But she was inheriting decisions that were taken by DUP ministers. I mean, the reality is Arlene Foster tried to obscure all of this by talking about an assembly vote on the issue, and it wasn't the case. They made the decisions. They need to own the decisions and take responsibility for the decisions.
Let's not forget that you were also in OFM-DFM together. Were the two leaders of the two parties not talking about breaking our health workers' pay, breaking parity?
Well, I wasn't in the executive. I'm not privy to what discussions there were between Peter Robinson and Martin McGuinness at that time. But
well, none of the rest of us are, and that's the point. Martin McGuinness, the late Martin McGuinness, and Sinn Féin as a political entity, I can't find any evidence that Sinn Féin stood up to our health workers' pay being less than the rest of the UK. I can't find anywhere where you fought against that.
Well,
I can find you trying to blame the DUP now.
Well, it's not trying to blame the DUP. The DUP took the decisions. So it's not about trying to blame them. They should own their decisions. That they took the decision at the time. They tried to obscure that now with talking about collective decisions. The executive meetings at the time, what the discussions were, I wasn't privy to them because I'm not part of the executive. But what I can say is that when Michelle O'Neill had the opportunity, she immediately gave the pay increase. She signalled that that was the beginning. That was a step in the right direction, I think, were the words that she used. She increased training places within that department, and she initiated the process of reform across the health service.
I would ask, for those of you who are geeks and anoraks, I would ask you, if you want to find this, to go to the legislation. And I will post the legislation on my Twitter feed straight after this show. I was reading it last night. The legislation, it gives legal effect to the requirement to seek executive approval. And I promise you, Connor, it's there. I promise you the DUP used it on a number of occasions. They defined something as a controversial issue and they attempted to block things on that basis. Indeed, they did block some things on that basis. If you accept what I'm telling you, that you had the power to declare that as a controversial issue and didn't, do you now apologise to the healthcare workers for not standing up for them when you could have done?
Well, I accept what you're saying to me. I don't know that that was the case. I don't know what challenges went in the executive at that time. I don't know whether a situation where a minister is awarding pay within his own department is considered a controversial issue or not.
You don't think it is?
I don't know. There has to be a test to establish that. So I don't know whether it would have been considered a controversial issue or not. I don't know whether it had been considered cross-cutting because it was within the confines of his own department and the people who worked for the health department. So therefore, in those circumstances, I don't know. I know what we did when we had the responsibility within that department.
I also know that the chair of the health committee was a Sinn Féin member.
Yeah.
Did they take any action?
Well, I don't know if the health committee had the ability to take action in relation to that. As I say, this was a matter internal to the health department, to workers who were employed by the health department. In that sense, it wasn't cross-cutting. So whether the health committee had an opportunity to take action or not, I don't know. But I know, as I say, what we did when we had the opportunity and control of that department.
I guess ask for your response when I point this out to our listeners this morning. You have members of the DUP standing on picket lines supporting health workers, and it was a DUP minister who made the decision to give them less money than people elsewhere in the UK. The DUP will argue it's a tough decision. And we now have Sinn Féin shouting from the rooftops about that decision, and you were in there and you could have stood up to them and you didn't.
Well, as I say, I'm not sure of the consequences of or the discussions around the executive table that time, because I'm not privy to them. I'm not privy to discussions around DFM. But what I do know is what we did when we had the opportunity to be in control of that department. I know what the course of action that Michelle O'Neill took, the signal that she sent that was the beginning of the issue of trying to restore that, and the fact that she created more training spaces because she was trying to also address the implication of the reduction in people's pay has an impact on retention and recruitment. And so it's not just about money in people's pockets, it's about the ability to recruit. And that's why there's a shortage of staff, and that's why there are patient safety issues. They all flow from the original decisions.
I want to let you have a listen to what Michelle O'Neill told me when she was Health Minister in 2016, when I interviewed her for Nolan Live.
There's fatigue out there in the system of report after report. This report clearly shows that we have a plan. We have executive endorsing a plan for the next 10 years, and I think that's significant in itself. It sends out a very strong message that there's not going to be no stop-start approach here. This is going to be a long, consistent, incremental change time after time. But what I did do very clearly in the document, I set out 18 points which we're going to deliver in year one. It very clearly shows that we're going to design services.
Not on waiting lists, you didn't?
Yes, I did. I've told you exactly what I'm going to do in relation to waiting lists.
No, you haven't. You said you're going to do...
I think, Stephen, we've already rehearsed this. I think I just told you that I'm going to bring
important.
That plan. Absolutely, it's important.
So waiting lists...
If you're an individual sitting waiting to be seen by the health service, yeah. It's the biggest thing in your life.
Exactly.
So I absolutely understand that.
So you might be sitting at home now thinking to themselves, OK, well, at least this minister is saying that she's set herself a target of reducing waiting lists by 10%. And if they hear that word incremental from you, they'll think, well, she's then promising a further 5% in year two, so we can hold her to account. What you're doing in this interview today, you're actually saying you're publishing another plan in January.
I think, in fairness, Stephen, with all due respect, you're focusing on one area of the health service.
Waiting lists.
Waiting lists are so... Absolutely,
and
I said that.
No,
I have said from the very start...
No target in this whatsoever.
I have said from the very start that waiting lists are unacceptable to me.
So what I'm trying to do by using that clip is to to be fair to Michelle O'Neill, she was identifying waiting lists as a huge problem, and she was. And in September 2016, she was talking about a 10-year plan within that interview, by the way. No stop-start approach, she said. Waiting lists were 243,000 in September 2016. They're now 306,000 September 2019. You knew that we needed a detailed plan around waiting lists. Michelle O'Neill promised us in that interview there would be no stop-start approach, and you walked out. You walked out of the executive that had the power to save people's lives. You just walked away.
No. Well, you know the reasons that brought the executive down.
Were they more important than saving lives?
Integrity in government is important as well. So how do you propose to solve the problems of public services if there is no integrity in government at all, if public confidence leaches away completely? The issues that brought down the executive are very, very clear. We had no desire to bring it down. Martin McGuinness struggled to the very end trying to offer Arlene Foster a way out of the mess that she'd created around herself, and they refused to take that, and he was left with no option but to bring the executive down. And since then, we have tried our level best to get the executive back in place again through negotiations with the DUP, with both governments and with the other parties.
Well, you say that, but if we remind ourselves why you walked out of government, one of the big red lines for you was Arlene Foster stepping aside because of her role in RHI until you found out the conclusion of an inquiry into RHI, correct?
Well, we initially asked her to step aside for 6 weeks,
correct.
If you remember.
Correct.
Yeah.
And she wouldn't do so?
No.
But that just has suddenly, because the RHI inquiry has not reported yet, that has suddenly fallen away. Now you will go back in an executive with Arlene Foster still in place.
Yes, we will.
So why was it so important there that you walked out and it's not so important now?
Well, because as your programme and many other programmes were reporting at the time, it was the biggest public scandal that had hit the administration here since the Good Friday Agreement. What we were trying to do was find a way to resolve that. The DUP, again, had ownership of the issue. We tried to get Arlene Foster to take a reasonable course of action. Bear in mind, we had asked her to step aside for 6 weeks. Other parties had demanded her resignation and say that they wouldn't serve with her in the executive
again. Yeah, but you're presumably getting my point that you targeted a unionist leader, You targeted Arlene Foster.
You didn't target anybody.
You targeted Arlene Foster.
Arlene Foster was the minister responsible for the RHI scheme. You know this. You've been through it many times.
Absolutely. And she is still the minister who was responsible for the RHI scheme.
She has been through a public inquiry now.
She has.
And this is yet to report.
Yeah,
you're correct.
You're prepared to walk into government before that RHI inquiry reports. What's changed?
What's changed is she should be out a lot longer than the 6 weeks that we asked her to be out for. We want to get
But she hasn't come out at all.
But she hasn't
from her role. She didn't step down from her role.
She's not the first minister, and she hasn't been the first
minister.
She's
the leader of her party
for 3 years.
The DUP refused to allow you to dictate who would be the leader of the DUP at any time. You didn't get your way.
We never at any stage asked the DUP to change its leader.
You asked her to step aside
from the role of first minister. It's up to the DUP at all stages to pick their party leader. Peter Robinson stepped aside as first minister when there was a question over land issues around his own, and he stepped aside for a period of time to clear that up. He remained as leader of the DUP. We at no stage asked Arlene Foster to step aside or asked the DUP, no more than they would tell us who to pick as our party leader. We wouldn't undertake to tell them who to pick as their. We asked her to step aside for a period of time to allow an inquiry to make a preliminary report. That's not the way the inquiry unfolded.
Exactly.
But yes.
So how come you're prepared to walk
because
back
we,
in? It would suggest that this was about optics. This wasn't about serious government.
No, it was absolutely not. Because I was there when Martin McGuinness took his decisions. I know the dilemma that he faced because he dearly wanted and had invested his entire life in the latter stages of his life in making sure that the institutions worked as they were designed under the Good Friday Agreement. And he clearly got to a stage where they were not working in that fashion and he had no option. But the RHI was the straw that broke the camel's back. It wasn't the only issue. It was the straw that broke the camel's back and Martin McGuinness was left with no option but to resign.
So to be clear, before the RHI inquiry reports, before it passes any judgment, if there is to be any, on Arlene Foster, you're prepared to go back into government with her?
Yes, and if there is judgment passed on her in relation to it, then she and her party need to take the consequences of that judgment.
So you might ask her to step aside again after the RHI report?
I'm asking her to consider what the inquiry recommends, if there are recommendations come from it. I don't know what the
inquiry
is going
to say. And what if she doesn't consider? Will you walk out again?
No, I'm saying that at that stage the Irish inquiry has done its job, it has reported its findings, and there is a big area of work to be undertaken as a consequence of that. And that's why the issues that we've been negotiating over the last 3 years involve and include behaviour in government, involve and include transparency, responsibility, integrity in government. And those issues are being addressed in the negotiations also.
So it doesn't matter what the RHI inquiry reports?
It doesn't matter what the RHI... The report of the RHI inquiry has big implications
by the way,
the entire
include,
system
it might
of government.
Include accusations about you lot.
Well, if it does, it does, and we'll deal with them if they do arise. But we weren't involved in setting up the RHI scheme or involving other people in it or supporting our families or involving our friends or encouraging people to apply for RHI schemes.
None of that applies to Arlene Foster, just to be clear. Can I put it to you that the thrust of this interview today is about should you not be in government? Should you not be delivering for people here rather than setting up all of these red lines before you go back in and deliver for people who are paying you to do that? And I'm hearing, and the Nolan Show has heard, that when you are on the doorsteps, you're getting hassle about this, that your party has been told, why aren't you back in there? Is that true?
No, we get a range of issues on the doorsteps, and I have to say it is no more or no less than issues we've been getting over the last 3-4 years. There is a desire to get Stormont up and running again, not only by us as a party, but by the people who support us and the people out there broadly in the community who want to see it. But they want to see it working on the right basis, and that is on the basis of the Good Friday Agreement, where integrity, respect, parity of esteem, equality, rights, all those things are guaranteed. Because, you see, we could walk in the morning or get involved in some parallel process as the DUP have been advocating. And if the government can't function properly on those basic requirements, which are the requirements of the Good Friday Agreement, then it won't be sustainable. And so the issues like health, which as Michelle was alluding to, are a 10-year plan which needs constant attention over that 10 years to make it work, then we won't be able to deliver any of those things if you have a stop-start government. And in order
so
to get...
So stop walking out then.
No, but because we have to get a government which is capable of delivering, which has an integrity about it, which is capable of affording people their rights.
Okay.
All these issues are important to people. We need a sustainable government, and that's why part of the issues that have been up for negotiation are around behaviour in government, sustainability, transparency, integrity. Those issues have all been on the table because we need a government which commands a bit of respect and confidence from people.
It's a statement of fact that in some of those rights you're talking about that you wanted, it was actually the British government which has delivered them. to people in Northern Ireland.
It was amendments in the British Parliament. They didn't come from the British government.
The British Parliament, then?
The British Parliament.
The British Parliament, yes. That you won't participate in. Because you say in your manifesto, an agreement was reached in February 18, wherever the DUP regretfully walked off the pitch. It's interesting that you're talking about the DUP walking off a pitch, given the conversation we've just had. You talk about the delivery of rights, which you've alluded to today, and you point in Northern Ireland to this. At the start of the year, after years of campaigning, same-sex couples will be able to marry the one they love. Mm. What you don't say in your manifesto, which is the truth, is it's the British Parliament which has delivered that to people in Northern Ireland. Sinn Féin failed to do so.
Well, we would have done so had we been able to secure an
but
agreement.
But you didn't. It was the British Parliament.
Yes, it did. And we made no bones of it. We asked the British government to step in and under the North-South Intergovernmental Conference procedures as part of the Good Friday Agreement and deliver those because they have jurisdiction in this place currently. So we asked the British government. The British government didn't deliver. It was actually an amendment voted through in the Parliament as other legislation trying to sort out the mess that we have was passing through Westminster.
And you do talk about this in your manifesto about how you say on page 8 of your manifesto, in Westminster we regularly met with every political party to explain the need to protect the Good Friday Agreement. We recognise the participation in Westminster political system was never going to deliver the results influence we wanted. But you talk about regularly meeting with every political party. And you've just alluded to asking the British government for help with same-sex marriage. Rather than being in there, a force in your own right. So you're meeting with the parties over there. You're over there quite a lot, you say. You're having to ask the British government. Why not get in there and represent people who are voting for you?
Because we made it very clear what we do. Can I say in relation to that, the British government has jurisdiction here. As part of the Good Friday Agreement, if rights issues are being denied, it is the responsibility of the government with jurisdiction to deliver on those. We asked the British government to live up to that responsibility and they refused to do so, primarily because they were reliant on the DUP to keep them in power. So the rights issues which the DUP managed to block in the Assembly when it was functioning, they were then being blocked in terms of the British government fulfilling its responsibility. Yeah. So it wasn't that we were asking the British government to do us a favour. We were telling them to live up to the commitments that they were required under the Good Friday
Agreement. You won't sit in government here and you won't participate.
We will sit
your
in government here. We will sit in government
here. Won't. Up until today, no, you will not.
We will sit in government here under the right circumstances. We could get, as I said,
any political party could say that, Colin.
No, we could get
and sit out.
We could get the executive up and running in the morning, but we are very clear that unless the circumstances are correct, it wouldn't last. And that, I think, given the situation we had, would be very, very damaging to the future of the Good Friday Agreement if we had another issue where we don't get the executive function on the way it was intended to be. The principles of the Good Friday Agreement are very clearly laid out. That's the entry price into the institutions of the Good Friday Agreement. Some parties have wanted to be involved in devolution, but not involved in genuine power sharing. Genuine power sharing is at the core of the Good Friday Agreement.
Under the section, making politics work, I wondered, is the word credible here code for your red lines? Because on page 13 of your manifesto, you say Sinn Féin stand ready to form a credible executive. And then you say, to be credible, all of the outstanding issues must be dealt with. So that sounds to me like, unless we get this, we're not going back in. To be credible, they must be dealt with. And you say, including an Irish Language Act. Now, are you telling me that on behalf of, again, all of those people whose kids don't have the right resources in school, those 300,000-odd people on a waiting list, that unless you get an Irish Language Act, you're refusing to represent people in this country in an executive?
But you do what a lot of commentators do. You play off the issue of public services against rights. They're not either-or issues.
They are an either-or if you're not going back into government.
They're not either-or issues
in Scotland.
They're
not
either-or issues in Wales. People have language rights in Wales and Scotland, and they have public services as well. And what we have done here is, because the DUP have an issue with affording people their rights, that we've tried to trade off this thing between public services and government and What we're saying is the Good Friday Agreement is a set of principles about genuine power sharing, about respecting identity. Yeah. Issues of identity and culture and political affiliation have divided the society since this state was formed.
But politics...
So if you want to get a power sharing administration which involves both sides of this community, then it has to be one based on respect.
Politics
is... So if one side of that equation can't afford respect, equality or parity of treatment, then the power sharing institutions don't function. That's what we've been trying to fix.
Okay, and I've watched... both of you, Sinn Féin and DUP, over many, many years. When you want to help each other, you do. You find language to help each other because sometimes you both back yourselves into corners and you can't get out of them, even if you want to. Now, I would put it to you that there must be a way, if Sinn Féin really did want to represent people on the ground here, who are sitting
on the
waiting
list. We do represent people on the ground.
In an executive, in a government
here. That's fair enough. That's where we want to be.
Okay.
And we know what is required to get
there. Then you don't need to describe something. Even if you want all of those Irish language rights, you don't have to make it a red line that it has to be an Irish language act, do you? The DUP have said, and yes, they've backed themselves in their corner too. Mm. And they have said, they're not giving you an Irish language act. And you're saying, unless you get one, you're not going back into government. Could you both not be more mature than that?
Listen, we've had many discussions over the last 3 years with the DUP, during which we managed to reach an agreement with them on this issue.
No act, no government. Is that where you're still at?
We managed to reach an agreement with the DUP on this issue in February 2018, which they agreed to, their party leadership agreed to, and then they failed to sell it to their own party membership.
Okay, but we're here. We're here in 2019 where there are over 300,000 people sitting on a wait list.
That to you, Stephen, is to say we had found a solution to all of that.
Okay, but
we can find a solution to all of that. The DUP were prepared to do a solution to all that. They need to step up the plate.
And they couldn't sell to their base or didn't want to sell to their base, whichever you want to say, anything that resembled an Irish Language Act. Now, I'm asking you again, on behalf of, and these are real, Conor, you know they're real. They live in your constituencies. On behalf of those people who are currently dying on a waiting list.
Yeah, but see, you try to trade off this emotional blackmail argument against the issue of rights as if the two things are exclusive to each other. They're not. They don't need to be. We can have a better society here. We can have one which affords people their rights and which tries to provide better public services. There is no big issue in all of that. Why using a minority position? The majority of people here are relaxed about an Irish Language Act. About Irish language rights for people. Why should we try and trade off the issue of rights of a society which is progressive and inclusive in which people aren't left behind with public services? We can have both if people are mature enough about it.
But my question to you, and then I'll move on, my question to you is that if you got adequate protection for Irish language speakers in this country, but it was not an Irish Language Act,
well, what I'm saying to you is we found a solution before and we can find a solution again.
Does that mean that this is not a red line in your manifesto? Because it smells like one and it sounds like
what
one.
What I've said clearly, there are a range of issues which we've been trying to address over negotiations with all of the parties and both governments. We all know what they are, a range of issues, which means we can have a properly functioning, sustainable institution which has credibility. Because bear in mind, when the institution went down, the credibility was at rock bottom. Well, so it has credibility and it has the potential of sustainability. Itself, so it can address some of the issues that you're referring to.
John Manley, the political correspondent for the Irish News, he has a front page story this morning. The headline, Government's Hope for Stormont Deal Within Weeks. And he writes that the Irish and British governments are increasingly optimistic that a deal to restore devolution can be brokered in the coming weeks. In recent days, DUP leader Arlene Foster and her Sinn Féin counterpart Mary Lou MacDonald have separately voiced the desire to restore the Stormont institutions. Has a deal been done?
No.
Is a deal close to being done?
A deal could be close to be done if there's political will to
has
do it.
Has a deal got closer to being done over recent weeks? Have talks been happening?
We have talked. No, there have been no talks happening probably since the end of the summer. Now, if the British government are upbeat and optimistic about that, then hopefully that means that they're coming to the table with the things they need to come to the table with in terms of legacy, in terms of citizenship rights, in terms of a restoration of some public funding for our public services as well. So hopefully they are bringing issues to the table rather than simply trying to be a referee in the middle of this. They have issues that they need to deliver on as well. Issues including clarity around unity referendum. All these issues have been presented to the British government to address. But
of course, we've been talking that long over the last 3 years. All of the issues are well rehearsed. The solutions to them are well known. If people come, we've said it ourselves, if people come with political will next week at this, there could be an executive up and running this side of Christmas. But we need political will to get these issues over the line.
An executive up and running this side of Christmas?
Well, we would like to see that. That probably would
What's
be
more realistic?
That probably would be challenging.
What's more realistic?
I don't know. It depends. I have to engage with other parties to find out what's realistic. I know there seems to be, from listening to parties speaking over the last number of weeks, a strong desire to get the executive up and running again. That may be because the DUP have realised that the Westminster show they've been involved in has come to an end, and they're now turning their attention back to the north. But if that is possible, if the political will is there, then a deal, of course, can be done. But it also involves the British government stepping up to the plate in terms of its responsibilities.
It was interesting that in your Ard Fhleisch speech, you said the biggest obstacle to progress was the DUP-Tory pact.
Yeah.
In the past, Sinn Féin has said it has been DUP arrogance and the denial of rights that was blocking a return to Stormont. Is the DUP-Tory pact about to crumble, and is that Sinn Féin preparing the ground for a return to devolution?
I mean, that has been undeniable. The British government, in our view, have never been neutral here, but whatever pretense at neutrality they had was swept aside when they were relying on the DUP to keep them in power. So various British Secretary of States here were attempting to conduct talks processes, and the DUP were talking directly to Downing Street over their heads. So the pact between the DUP and the British government was the biggest obstacle, because the British government couldn't even attempt to fulfil the role it's obliged to do under the terms of the Good Friday Agreement, which is to act responsibly and neutrally in a position of neutrality in relation to all of these matters.
I've only got another 15 minutes to speak to you, and there's so much I want to talk to you about. I mentioned the lack of any type of substantive detail around health in your manifesto. Do you know the word that isn't mentioned once? Abortion. I wonder why.
Well,
is that not an election issue?
Our position on that has been very clear, and we've campaigned on it in the South. We have voted on it.
It's not clear in your manifesto. It's not in it.
Well, we have a submission ready to go into the consultation that is out in relation to abortion. We have talked on it many, many times.
What is it? What is your policy on abortion?
Our policy is the position that was adopted in the South and as part of the Repeal the Eighth campaign. That is in the cases
of... So you support abortion some circumstances?
In certain limited circumstances, yes. And we have not only argued for that, but we have legislated for it in the South as well. And we have the same position in relation to here.
In the South, you can have an abortion. In the South, you can have an abortion up to 12 weeks.
Yes,
that's Sinn Féin's position in Northern Ireland.
Yes, because the Oireachtas Committee that looked at that determined that you couldn't legislate in a compassionate way for people who are the victims of rape or incest, unless you allowed abortion up to a limited period of 12 weeks.
Some people would say that's abortion on demand up until 12 weeks. Well, is that Sinn Féin's? Does Sinn Féin support abortion on demand up to 12 weeks?
We support the position that the Oireachtas Committee came to, who wanted to approach this a way of defining how abortion would be carried out in the case of rape or incest. And they found that to do that compassionately, to put somebody through some sort of test within 12 weeks to prove that they were a victim of rape or a victim of incest, you couldn't legislate compassionately. So therefore, they came to the only conclusion they could, that there had to be free access to that.
But that's, they came to that conclusion.
Yes, and I'm asking,
Sinn Féin believes...
We supported that position. Okay. We voted for it in the Dáil.
So Sinn Féin believes that any woman has the right in any circumstance to an abortion up to 12 weeks.
Yeah, but there are medical assessments to be taken in relation to that. Yes, and that was the position that the committee came to when they came from a variety of different views in terms of support or opposition to abortion, and they came to the view, having listened to all the medical advice, having listened, taken advice across the country in relation to this, that the only way to compassionately legislate for that was to allow that access. It hasn't, in my understanding, caused any free-for-all in relation to requests for abortion.
I just wonder, are you selling that to people in the doorsteps, or are you trying to avoid that discussion with it not being in your manifesto?
Absolutely not.
Why is it not there?
Well, as I say, this was a Brexit election, and we have absolutely talked about this issue. Can I say, Stephen, at Ard Fhleisch, every year for the last 10, 12 years, we've had full-flown debates on abortion. We came to a position a couple of years ago in supporting the Repeal the Eighth campaign in the South and mandating our people in the Oireachtas, in the Dáil, to legislate for this. We came to a very clear view in relation to that. Now, there are people who take issue with that. There are people in Sinn Féin, people who support Sinn Féin, who take issue with that. I understand that. They're very strongly held views.
You might lose votes because of your up to 12 weeks policy,
well be the
right?
case.
Are you losing many?
That may well be the case. Well, I'm not getting it very much on the doors, not any more than in previous elections, but that may well be the case. I respect people having very, very strong views in relation to this issue. I respect people in Sinn Féin who have very strong views on this issue. But that was the position that the Ardèche came to. That was the democratic mandate that was given to people who find themselves in legislations. And should we find ourselves back in the Assembly legislating for it, it would be on the same policy.
I looked also, Conor, at the manifesto, and there was actually a section in the manifesto which broke down in orange and green. It actually depicted it in orange and green, the percentages of people who would vote for a united Ireland or not. Is that really a modern Sinn Féin, that you bring it back to orange and green in your manifesto?
I think the pie charts that were used in that came from the Ashcroft poll originally, which represented orange and green colours. And secondly, I think if people take offence at the colours of the pie charts in our party manifesto, then they're unlikely to be in agreement with the unity
issue.
It
brings me to my next theme, though, which is, are you a party that is seriously wanting to reach out to unionists in Northern Ireland and to say that unionists have a place in Northern Ireland as much as nationalists if there was a united Ireland? And because you point that Ashcroft poll that you point to that is in your manifesto, and it talks about Irish unity, 40% of 18 to 24-year-olds wanted to stay in the UK. Yes, that means a majority. I give you that. 45% 25 to 44-year-olds, 49% 45 to 64-year-olds, 62% over 65. So we can both agree that while you're pointing to majorities in that poll with those younger people, there is absolutely a significant amount of people that are wondering what would a united Ireland be like for them. What can you say to them?
What I'm saying to them is they should find a way to engage in the debate. And what I say to them very clearly is we have argued that whatever protections are afforded through the Good Friday Agreement in terms of citizens' rights, human rights, all of those issues should be afforded to any minority on this country if there was a single state the island.
But it's also about mindset, isn't it? And when they, for example, hear when one of your candidates, John Finucane, was asked if he would condemn the attempted assassination of him when he was visiting his son in hospital, and John Finucane refused to condemn that, what does that say about Sinn Féin?
Well,
if he represents their mindset?
Well, firstly,
he doesn't like selective condemnation.
In relation to talking to union people, like in my experience, and I've talked and involved in community outreach, private conversations for many, many, many years, and they like straight talking. They like it to tell you where you're coming from, absolutely not insulting people or offending people, but straight talking to know what your prospects are, what your policies are, what you want to
tell
achieve.
Tell you what, it's pretty straight to find any human being that won't condemn the attempted assassination of another when he's visiting his sick son in hospital.
But what you do and other commentators do is you try and break this down incident by incident. So you're asking a man whose father was shot dead in front of him when he was a 7-year-old child and his mother was wounded as well to get into this what about issues in terms of condemnation. I mean,
He's asked a straight question.
When a father is visiting his son in hospital, that's
not something that can be very quickly condemned.
But you condemn
Bloody Sunday, don't you? Is that not a specific incident?
Did you ask the DUP to condemn the killings on Bloody Sunday as well when they're supporting Soldier F? You know, should they condemn the killings were declared unjustified? Have they ever been asked to condemn those who were involved in the killings? They support Soldier F. Have you ever asked a Tory minister or any British government minister when you've had him on your show to condemn the killing of children by plastic bullets? You see, you get down to a selective thing where one person has to single out one issue and then somebody quotes back another issue and then you complain about whataboutery. I mean, the way to deal with these issues is not to get into individual cases and say, well, you condemn that and you justify it and you don't justify this.
The way to deal with this is through the process that we agreed at Stormont House, which is a broad range of mechanisms to cover the legacy issue, to try and support victims and get victims access to whatever support and truth, recovery and justice issues they want to achieve.
Do you think a younger generation, some of those younger people who are in a different Northern Ireland now, and they listen to you justify and defend a candidate in this election who is not prepared to say, yeah, that's abhorrent. Someone trying to assassinate a father when they're visiting their sick son in hospital. I would put it to you that there would be a sizeable younger generation now that would think it's just unconscionable.
Well, I would put it back to you that there are a lot of people who think, why do journalists pick over certain scabs and ignore other huge wounds? Why is the demand for John Finucane, who is a victim in the Troubles, who lost his father in Troubles, why is the demand of him to get involved in an issue involving a candidate who stood against him?
I think any decent person would say it is abhorrent for him to have lost his father in the Troubles. I think any decent person would say that anybody that loses their father...
It's was lost in the Troubles at all.
No, but I think the way to address it, I've
listened to victims' representatives in your show who have said the way to address these things is not for people to pick over individual scabs and try and ring up victims and ask them for a reaction to this or a reaction to that. The way to fix these issues as best we can, and we may never fix them for everyone, but the way to fix these issues as best we can is through legacy mechanisms which give people access to truth and through that an attempt to create some reconciliation. But you see, a demand is made of people in Sinn Féin, which isn't made of other people. So there's no demand of British government ministers to justify killings or to condemn killings. There's no demand made of the DUP.
Sinn Féin are demanding that those killings are scrutinised. Sinn Féin are demanding in the manifesto that there will be scrutiny and that there will be justice and that there will be absolutely no amnesty for any British soldier ever.
Because that's what's been proposed in Westminster, to create a special particular amnesty for British soldiers who are involved in killings.
Would it be all right to give them an on-the-run letter?
The on-the-run letter doesn't give anybody an amnesty. Have you ever read one? The on-the-run letter states very specifically you are not wanted at this present stage, and if any evidence arrives in the future which changes that circumstance, you are liable to be subject to arrest and prosecution. You see, the people who quote the on-the-run letters ignore that part of it, and they try to talk about get-out-of-jail cards. So, you know, there are a lot of issues here which we can, and we can get into this batting back and forth, which ends up sounding like whataboutery. But, you know, people, for instance, who served in the British Army, who were involved and convicted of killing people, were taken back into the British Army, and your tax money and my tax money was used to pay their wages and to give them pensions. The people who were victims of the killings they did, their tax money was used to pay them
wages.
You
were prepared to talk about specific incidents. You didn't want John Downey prosecuted, did you?
Because John Downey was given a letter to say that he wasn't wanted for prosecution. That was tested in court. And he handed himself over in order to... He surrendered himself for extradition. Contrast his treatment with people who are charged in relation to Bloody Sunday, who don't have to show up to court, who aren't kept in prison and denied bail.
Do you know what, Conor? I think we can both agree that the DUP... I'm not going to be on their Christmas card list, right?
No, you start down this road.
I do.
You start down this road and then you end up saying you're all about whataboutery.
No.
Because you try and address specific issues
I'm just putting this to you.
I'm saying that you don't serve victims well by going down this route of trying to pick over some scabs and leaving other gaping wounds unattended to.
I'm just putting it to you that is it not just the definition of sick to try to assassinate someone when they're on their way to hospital to visit their sick son? Now, that's what happened to Nigel Dawes. Yes. And I'm never going to be on his Christmas card list, right?
But can you get
I don't care.
Can you get similarly outraged?
Is that not sick?
Can you get similarly outraged by the actions of somebody who shoots a child in the head with a plastic bullet and kills him? You know, I don't ever hear you express an outrage.
I think the vast majority of people in Northern Ireland would say yes.
But what do you say?
When
you have a British government minister in here, do you ask them to condemn that? Do you ask them, is that not sick? Do you ask them, are they not appalled by that? Do you ask them to explain themselves in relation to it? You see, you don't have a consistent or a level playing field in these issues. We try to create one through the legacy mechanisms agreed in Stormont House, and they still haven't been implemented 5 years on because the British government are dragging their heels on them.
Welfare reform There's a cliff edge coming up, isn't there, in March of next year?
Yes.
And this was something that the British government, again, the Tory party and their welfare reform, it basically meant that people here would have their benefits cut. Mitigation was brought in, and that mitigation is running out in March. It's a statement of fact that Sinn Féin agreed to hand over the power to the British government to do that.
It's a statement of fact that the welfare package of mitigation, which everyone now is very attached to, would not have been in place unless Sinn Féin had threatened to bring down an executive over it. And we were on our own fighting that battle to get that welfare package. And
if you're not back in by March,
no,
I mean, your people might, the Sinn Féin electorate might suffer again.
Firstly, our intention is to be back in. But secondly,
by March?
Earlier, if possible. Secondly, if the civil servants have the authority to take decisions in relation to matters in which were executive policy or executive agreements in relation to, there clearly was an executive agreement in relation to a welfare package of mitigation funds and for what that was intended. So I don't see any reason why the civil servants can't, if there isn't an executive placement, cannot continue with that.
And what if? And what if the people that you
it was a clear
you're wanting their
policy.
Vote? Yeah, but what if there's a line pumped out again, similar to what's being pumped out about the nurses? It's for the executive to handle that, and you're not in there because of an Irish Language Act. What if?
No, listen, the British government tried to do this with the HIA package of compensation, to say we will pay this out if you get an executive in place, then we won't take it out of your budget, but if you don't get an executive in place, then we will take it out of your budget. There are people have attempted to use these situations for their own ends. The reality is that the civil servants, if they're continuing on with what was agreed executive policy, which clearly the welfare mitigation package was, then they should continue that on in March. Our intention is to be back in an executive before then, but there is no reason why they should not continue that on in the absence of an executive.
Two more minutes.
Okay.
Again, a whole theme of this interview for me has been about the reality of you not being in an executive in order to represent people more effectively. And you tell me that you really do want to be in there. Aside from an Irish Language Act, what else is a stumbling block? It can't be same-sex marriage because it's here. Well, what else?
There were five working group areas as part of the discussion since last March, April. There are issues around transparency. There are issues around sustainability. There are issues around the petition of concern and its uses, because the issue of rights...
Are they red lines?
It doesn't stop. These are things to be negotiated out. I mean, I know you love this red line phrase, but these are things that... The issue about red lines is if we don't get an executive back in place which can sustain itself and function properly, then it won't last.
Okay.
So the issue of the petition of concern, because rights issues don't stop with equal marriage or with reproductive rights. Rights issues continue on.
Okay.
And so we don't want to end up in a situation where rights are denied again.
To be fair to you, you've come into the studio today, and I'm grateful for that. You've taken difficult questions, as have all the other parties, except the DUP. I want to give you a few seconds to tell people why they should vote for you.
Well, I think, as we had said at the outset, this election is primarily about Brexit. There are a range of public services which are suffering as a consequence of austerity, but people do have an opportunity to reject Brexit, to vote to remain again. And I hope people across all constituencies come out to vote remain, because there is a majority here for it. I think we need to reassert that, and we need to give the British government a clear message, but also Dublin and Brussels and Washington, that the people here want protections for this part of Ireland as part of whatever Brexit arrangements pertain on the other side of this.
Conor, thanks for coming in. Happy Christmas.
And happy Christmas to you, Stephen. Thank you.
Here's the 10 o'clock news.